The history of television is a history of failure.
For every television series that lasted years and years, there were dozens that lasted only one season or less.
But did they deserve to die? Or were they canceled too soon?
Everybody, and welcome back to Canceled Too Soon, the podcast where we review television series that lasted only one season, or less. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a critic. No nickname?
No.
I guess you can call me Tommy. Or Kevin. We're dealing with a show where I'm going to mix up all of the names of the characters, because they have the most generic names of any TV characters.
And to a certain extent, some of them feel a little interchangeable, and it's going to make this rather sprawling mob storyline a little difficult to convey. But that is the challenge which we have taken upon ourselves.
It aspires to be sprawling. It doesn't quite sprawl. It kind of splats.
It congeals. We're talking today on our podcast where we talk about failed television series, a show we've had a lot of requests for over the years, and we finally got around to it. Let's talk about the Black Donnellys.
You remember the Donnellys, right?
Four brothers who can only count on one thing.
Hey, be careful.
Each other.
We're his brothers. He needs us.
Make this right.
The Black Donnellys, Monday, February 26th. Get an exclusive DVD of the pilot at netflix.com/NBC.
Now, if you heard that clip, first off, you may have heard the rather interestingly dated "get the first episode on Netflix DVD" bit, which just makes me chuckle. But you may think, based purely on listening to that audio clip, that this is a story about family. This is a story about brothers. This is going to be the new One Tree Hill.
Oh my goodness. I can't tell you how annoyed I am every time a publicist or a preview will sell a film or a TV series as being about family, which is what they say when they actually don't know what the hell they've got.
Most things are about family. Unless they're pointedly not.
Member in it, then yeah, it's about family.
On some level, yeah. Mm. Like, again, some movies are pointedly not, but if there's family in it, Yeah, it's kind of about family, isn't it?
I remember first noticing that during the press junkets for Batman and Robin back in the late 90s. Like, what is this new Batman film? Well, it's about family, really. Batman forms a family. Well, yeah, I guess because you have a lot of character. No, it's not about anything, that movie.
Yeah.
But they said it's about family. The Black Donnellys is at least about four brothers.
True.
The Donnellys.
Yep, they are Irish American, and they own a bar called the Firecracker.
Yeah, and it is about their ambitions to enter the world of organized crime.
Well, it's not so much their ambitions to enter the world of organized crime, so much as how they sort of accidentally, through sheer force of stupidity, stupidity, violence, greed and
complete lack of impulse control
and just absolute luck, they wind up becoming an actual force within the organized crime community just because they're hooligans.
They just
run around beating people up and extorting money, and then all of a sudden everyone's like, I guess they're powerful now. We're like, when did that happen? Shit.
A few vital stats. The Black Donnellys is an NBC series. It debuted and failed in early 2007.
It aired from February 26th through May 14th, 2007. It debuted right after a really noteworthy episode of Heroes, which for the first season...
Oh, yeah, I remember Heroes.
The first season of Heroes was a monster. People forget this right now.
Everyone's talking about that show.
If you're too young to remember like when it was like making its debut... Heroes, the first season's quite good. It was, you know, the story about how a whole bunch of people all around the world started getting superpowers at the same time, and And it was kind of like Nashville, but with heroes. And also, they took a lot from The Watchmen. But it was very, very popular. And it was really driving the zeitgeist for the first season, the way that shows like Lost or Twin Peaks did. And there was a mysterious character who had horn-rimmed glasses, and nobody knew what was up with him. And there was a whole episode dedicated just to that guy. And it was like a must-see episode. Like, secrets are going to get revealed. And to be fair, they were, actually. Kudos to heroes. When they said they were going to reveal stuff, they did. So I remember watching that episode, like live, because I didn't have DVR yet. And I was watching the episode. I'm like, oh, okay. So I'm glad I know all about that guy. Oh, there's a new show. I guess I'll watch this Black Dog. I watched the first episode. It did not grab me. I know a lot of people are a big fan of this show, and I'm going to try to figure out like why that is. I know that the Black Donnellys was part of a wave, I think, of crime sagas that were hitting television. There was no shortage of crime sagas before The Sopranos, but I think The Sopranos brought them into the 21st century.
I was going to say that The Sopranos kicked off the imitators, the trends. Yeah. This was also, and we've talked a lot about how the 2000s were when TV was really transforming in a lot of ways, from independent episodes to these gigantic, sprawling, serialized narratives. Mm. Cable had a lot more freedom to do that sort of thing with shows like Oz and The Sopranos and 6 Feet Under. Network TV, it took them a little while to sort of catch up to that level of quality and interconnectedness.
Yeah, there are exceptions here and there, but it took a little while.
So, but this was an early example of these gigantic super narratives that stretched over the course of a season. And I think a lot of people were just attracted to that. It was popular with audiences at the time. And it had not a huge amount of star power. The biggest star might be Kate Mulgrew.
At the time. You know, yeah.
She was the biggest get. And she's... like, she kind of slips in and out of the show, like, almost surreptitiously. Like, she doesn't play a major role. Like, she doesn't announce her presence. The show doesn't really sell her entrance.
What's weird, Kate Mulgrew, by the way, the name sounds familiar and you can't picture her, she was Captain Janeway in Star Trek Voyager. She was also Billy Crystal's wife in Throw Mama from the Train, which I had seen as a kid, and then I watched it after Voyager. I'm like, hey! Like, one of those.
Well, and she was also in soap operas. She was just a TV mainstay for a long time.
An excellent actor, no doubt about it. But what's interesting about Kate Mulgrew's presence in The Black Donnellys, she's not in the pilot, and then in like the first shot of episode 2, she's there with the family as though she was there the whole time.
Yeah.
And I'm like, no, you actually have to introduce Kate Mulgrew. Who is this woman? She plays the mother of the Black Donnellys.
And the other known, she wasn't a huge presence at the time, but she's now gone on to become a movie star and a great director in her own right, is Olivia Wilde.
Yeah.
Who plays co-owner of a local diner with her father, who has sort of like on again, off again, romantic relationships with one of the Donnellys. And her dramas are sort of like B-plots in a lot of episodes, because they don't really overlap in too significant ways with a lot of the crime stuff.
Yeah, she had already been in stuff like The O.C. and movies like Alpha Dog and Turistas. But it wasn't until just after The Black Donnellys that she got, I think, what was her big breakout role, which was on House.
That's right.
Which was my first like introduction to her, and she was a real standout on that series. So this was, it's probably like, if the Black Donnellys hadn't been canceled, she might not have ended up on House, and then her career might not have shot off to where it is. So, bit of history.
The great irony is that the four main Black Donnellys are not known at all. None of them were big gets, and I haven't seen any of them in anything since.
That's not fair. Jonathan Tucker, I think, is a highly respected character actor. He was in The Virgin Suicides. He had been in, before this, the remake of Texas Chainsaw Massacre. He was on that show Parenthood. He was on Justified. He's on that show Snowfall.
All right. So he's worked a lot in things I haven't seen.
He was also in the pilot episode of American Gods in a role where it's just like, he's a distractingly big character actor for a guy who has only one scene. And if you've read the book, you know he's important later. Oh. So like, they were setting him up for like a big thing. Right. Now that show's canceled, so that'll never come together. But he's a good actor, and that he's another one who I think was like sort of being set up for greatness, but it just never quite hit like movie star level with him, which is unfortunate because I think he's really talented, actually. But let's run through the main cast real fast. Tommy
is sort of the main character.
Yeah, he's played by Jonathan Tucker. Mm. Tommy is, I believe he's the eldest son of the Black Donnellys. And he's the one who is the most clear-headed. He's trying to keep his brothers out of trouble. His brothers are varying degrees of oblivious to dangerously violent and irresponsible. And so keeping track of them is a hard thing to do. But at the beginning of the series, he's actually trying to get his life together. He's going to art school. He's trying to keep his head, his nose clean. And then the events of the pilot basically ruin that for him because
he goes through the Michael Corleone arc, in the pilot episode.
Yeah.
He's trying to stay out of crime, but his no good Nick brothers are all. Yeah. They really want to drag him down. And there's a lot of incident in the pilot that sets up all of the action for the rest of the series.
Yeah. In a nutshell, what it boils down to is the second youngest Donnelly brother, Kevin, played by Billy Lush, is a gambler and he never wins. And he is in really deep and owes a lot of money. And their solution is to kidnap the bookie. Which doesn't go great. No.
They accidentally kill the bookie.
That guy dies badly. Yeah. and now it's up to Tommy, who's desperately trying to keep this thing together, and their brother Jimmy, who's
like the hothead of the group.
Jimmy is, and you look at his performance, especially later in the series. Jimmy's played by an actor named Tom Geary. He seems to be going for Robert De Niro in Mean Streets. This early, very energetic, very angry at the world, sort of rebellious guy who has a certain magnetism but is undeniably dangerous. I don't really get the magnetism from Jimmy. I think he's just the kind of guy where you're just like, we should just... He seems like he's setting himself up to be Fredo in The Godfather, where it's like, okay, you clearly want to be involved, but every single thing you touch, you destroy. And my prediction is, had the series gone on, eventually Tommy would have had to kill him.
Not Sonny, not Fredo.
No, Fredo. Sonny is James Caan. Caan dies, but James Caan is just shot at a toll booth. No, yeah. Fredo's the one who like betrays the family. Fred is the one who's trying so hard to be a part of it.
I saw Jimmy as Sonny, the sort of hothead who's like really trying to be involved in something a lot more sophisticated that he doesn't really understand and just keeps on failing, but somehow he's lucky enough to get out of trouble, like just barely every time.
Well, I can see that too.
We're going to make a lot of Godfather parallels.
I'm sure we are. Mm-hmm. And then the youngest brother is Sean. Played by Michael Stahl David, who you may remember from Cloverfield.
And he's the Zeppo of the group.
Yeah, he's in the first episode, because of all of the shit that Jimmy, and I already forgot, Kevin. Kevin's so forgettable, I'm sorry.
Jimmy, Kevin, Sean, and Tommy.
Yeah, Jimmy and Kevin get in so much trouble.
Couldn't we name one like Aloysius or something?
Jimmy and John, Xerxes. Jimmy and Kevin get in so much trouble that the whole family is under fire. Sean gets the shit kicked out of him. He ends up in like a coma, like really, really bad. And he was like the pretty one. And like when he gets out of the coma, he's like ashamed of his face because he was like the handsome one, like the guy who got all the girls. And the guy was actually pretty straight laced and not really a problem. And he just kept getting dragged into these horrible shenanigans.
And he's none too bright, so he just sort of goes along with it.
Yeah. He's my favorite character, not because he's interesting, but because I don't hate him. Like, he doesn't do anything, like, really terrible.
There's no attempt to make these characters likable, and I think that was sort of the MO of the show. They wanted to make a show about scumbags and criminals.
Yeah.
People who are, you know... And this was another trend at the time. Characters like Dexter or Mr. Breaking Bad or The Sopranos.
Well, those are pronouncedly dark. And I think this is supposed to have like a early 20s, dudes making mistakes, kind of energetic charm to their wickedness.
A little bit,
like,
but I think...
definitely supposed to enjoy watching
But
them.
There are like scumbags, there's, drug addiction and murder and these guys aren't good guys. They do horrible things and they're not apologetic about it. And I think that was supposed to be part of the thrill. Yeah. I don't know where this lines up with a show like Breaking Bad or Dexter, but they're about the same time. This is 2007.
Yeah, but Breaking Bad and Dexter are about people who are... First off, they're about individuals. There's an ensemble cast, but there's definitely one focal point. And Dexter, it's a serial killer. And Breaking Bad, it's like...
But you understand what I mean, right?
I do. I just want to say where I think the delineation is. Right. Where in that one, those are stories about people who are already like... In Dexter's case, he's already doomed. His darkness is a part of him. And Breaking Bad, it's about someone's absolute fall from grace. And here, this seems like just one of those, you know, organized crime stories where a bunch of people just fall into all of these patterns and it becomes this sort of a familial tragedy in a very Scorsese, Coppola sort of way. Except Irish. Although Scorsese did work with the Irish, The Departed, won Best Picture.
It's kind of frustrating. I was thinking of The Departed, so every time they would like go out into the street, I like had to remind myself that this didn't take place in Boston.
Yeah.
It takes place in New York, and it's not very New York though. Like they don't try to capture sort of the essence of New York. So it could be Boston, it could be anywhere.
Well,
really.
I think it was shot in Canada, which wouldn't surprise me. Also filling out the cast, as we said, Olivia Wilde plays Jenny, who grew up with them. Her father has a diner, which is across the street from the Firecracker Bar that the boys own, and they won it in like a gambling session. Tommy's been in love with her since forever. Jimmy's been in love with her since forever, although that doesn't come up too often. But the problem is that for a variety of shitty reasons, they never got together. She ended up marrying another guy. That guy ended up getting involved in organized crime. And there's a bit, and I kind of wish they'd explored this a bit more, because there's a very almost unique tragedy to this. Everyone in town knows that her husband got murdered for getting involved in shit he shouldn't have gotten involved with, except her. And they won't tell her because they don't want to break her heart. Problem is that she still keeps thinking he's going to come home someday. Like, she's still married. She's very Catholic. So even though technically she's a widow and she could move on with her life, she feels like she can't. So early in this series, when sparks start flying with Tommy again and they sleep with each other, it kind of rips her apart inside. That's actually a more interesting plot than a lot of this, you know, murder that's happening elsewhere. But in the pilot episode, they get involved with this whole thing with this bookie who gets kidnapped, and then he gets killed, so they can't produce him and make everything right again. And now, at the end of the episode, Sean is in the hospital, and Tommy is told Jimmy is a fuck-up. And the Irish Mafia says, we need to get Jimmy to go to the Italians, whose bookie you kidnapped and killed, even though I don't know that. He's going to get the shit kicked out of him. And Tommy knows that what that means is they're going to kill him. And he doesn't want his brother to die. So he walks into this tavern with the local leader of the Italian mob and the local leader of the Irish mob, who he's known for decades as a friend of the family, and he kills them both. And that's the end of the pilot. Oh, shit. That's actually going to be a problem, isn't it?
And, okay, you got story.
Yeah.
But this is one of those pilots where maybe they didn't think that out, and they just sort of, like, to borrow a term from a video game critic I watch a lot of, a fuck-up cascade. There's a phenomenon this critic talks about in video games where if you're stealthing through a certain section, you make one small mistake, and that sort of alerts every bad guy in the video game, and you're just dead instantly.
Yeah, there was, like one path to victory in which you didn't, like, interact with anybody, and the coast is clear, and if one guy knows you and go, hey, then all of a sudden every bad guy in the game is jumping on you, and there's no way
you make one tiny mistake, and it's essentially game over. And so I feel like that's the approach with the Black Donnellys.
And that's the kind of storyline where you can imagine that being almost this, like, Coen Brothers thing, where all of a sudden a couple of dopey guys who were just doing their best do something really horrifying, and now they're completely in over their heads, and they're just trying to find a way to get out of it. And I can imagine that working for 90 minutes if this was the inciting incident.
Or if the characters were actually trying to get out of it. But this is a story about how they kind of roll with it.
Yeah.
And they try to use their mob connections that they're now just developing And a big story is about how they try to do the mob thing, where they go into people's businesses and shake them down for protection money.
Yeah.
And they take over somebody else's roots, and they end up killing that guy.
Yeah.
And they're actively trying to take over all organized crime in this neighborhood.
So the first couple of episodes are about the fallout from this, and now there's a power vacuum, and the Italian mob is now run by a guy named Doki, played by Peter Green, who I will always remember as the bad guy from The Mask. That's kind of the big role he's in. But he's a good, reliable character. I always like him.
He's also... he was in Pulp Fiction as well.
Oh, yeah. He was the guy who ran the antique store. Anyway, good actor. I'm always a fan of Peter Green. So he comes in, and it turns out that the head of the Irish mob that Tommy killed was his brother, so now he's wandering around town chopping off people's toes trying to find out who killed his brother, and meanwhile he's interacting constantly with Tommy, who's like, hey, it wasn't me. So that's going on. We have a young upstart, or youngish upstart, in the Italian mob named Nicky, played by Kirk Acevedo, who is also trying to manipulate the Donnellys into getting what he wants, which is to race through the ranks of the Italian mob. The first couple episodes are about the Black Donnellys trying to basically cover up the murder, trying to get away with all of this, and then eventually it just sort of settles down. Problems keep arising where Tommy is like, hey, Kirk Acevedo, Nicky is like, okay, so you know the whole thing with the bookie? Yeah, well, until he gets back, he owes us money, like, every week. That's his job, and if he doesn't get back, we don't get that money. So until he comes back, he's dead in a ditch somewhere. Until he comes back, you will pay me $2,500 a week. There's a thing in crime stories that always baffles me, which is that these...
Well, I have something too, but what's yours?
Well, the one I want to talk about right now, this isn't unique to the Black Donnellys. It's like all crime stories. And maybe this is just a different type of world and community and economic system than I am used to. But everyone is always really poor and working class, and everyone always has shit tons of money. It's always like, hey, you owe your bookie $5,000. Oh, all I can raise is $2,500. I couldn't tell you the last time I had $2,500.
Like, I could not hustle with, like, all of my resources, and all of the people I know, and just sort of scrounge up $2,500.
I could take my entire DVD collection, of which I am rather proud, and sell it at Amoeba Records and maybe get a few hundred for it.
Yeah, maybe get like, I'd say you're pushing 500.
Maybe.
If
they're feeling generous, like that's that's it. Those are all my liquid assets. Like, I got nothing. So, like, I don't understand really baffling, where people get all this money from. They're all poor, and they all have all this money. I put $5,000 on the ponies. Where did you get the $5,000? Like, you live in a studio apartment.
I lost all this money, but you had it at some point.
Right.
It's like,
how do you have it to gamble?
There's going to be a plot point later in the show where Zeppo gets his own car, and the joke is that it's this, like, it has over 200,000 miles. It's this, like, rust bucket car, but he's really proud of it because he's never had one before.
Right.
But they're still, like, handing wads of, like, $20,000 in cash to one another. It's like, is this, like, 6 months of salary for you? What does that money mean in that world?
Yeah, money is just this weird blob of of green that people have in their pockets. And it's like... I don't understand, like, financially what stakes are in this universe.
At least
like, $2,500 a week, how am I going to raise that? Dude, you fucking, like, there's an episode in this where they manage to, like, bribe, steal, and cajole their way through all of New York bureaucracy over the course of a day. Mm. I don't think it's hard for you to get $2,500 anymore. I just don't. It seems like nothing to you. It's the world to me. It seems like nothing to you.
That's if they were living in luxury, like in the movie Scarface, like they had a mansion or they had, you know, dozens of cars,
I would say fine.
That makes a little bit more sense. What I have always been baffled by in these sort of mob dramas, especially the street level mob dramas, is why would you want to go into organized crime when you could be killed? And it seems like so much goddamn work.
Yeah.
It's like, after all of this hustling, and you're on call 24 hours a day, and you have to murder people, and you're constantly in danger, And at the end of the day, it's like you're just sort of making minimum wage,
right?
When it all evens out,
well,
it doesn't make sense. All this pride is now involved in it, and you know, all of this. It's like, you wronged me, so I'm going to murder you. It's like, well, or you could just suffer those same indignities at a minimum wage job and kind of come out the same,
and then not die,
and no one would be killed. Well, I mean, there's an advantage.
It's important to remember that a lot of these types of worlds, and they exist in real life. People fall into them because it's what they grow up with a lot of the time. It's their neighbors, it's their family. So this pattern of behavior, this lifestyle, isn't that weird. So it's not something to aspire to. They're just already there.
Yeah.
A lot of the time. I'm not speaking for everybody, but you know, I do know people, and I've read a lot. And,
I understand that, and I've seen a lot of crime dramas about living in a crime-riddled place and how it's just sort of the natural place where you go. I talked recently about City of God.
Yeah.
And that's an excellent example of that. How, well, when you're a boy, that's kind of the only option you have.
Well, and I think the whole setup for this for this show is that there's two brothers who are idiots who fall into it because they don't think about consequences. And there's one brother who's genuinely smart, who is actively trying not to do this shit, but keeps getting roped into it because otherwise his brothers would die, and he's the only one smart enough to prevent that for them. And that's supposed to be the tragedy. This person's supposed to be... It's the Michael Corleone thing. Mm-hmm. Oh, he was so smart. He was so bright. He was being, like, groomed to be the member of the family who was not involved in organized crime. But because of circumstances outside of his control, it was his responsibility to set up, and it changed his entire path. But you bring up an interesting point, which is that the world of organized crime, and as we see it in movies, I don't have a lot of connections to it. It's a really nerve-wracking lifestyle. And that's something you almost never see in a mob movie. Someone with, like, anxiety. And I don't mean just, like, someone who has anxiety. It's like someone who is, like, clinically has anxiety. Someone who's, like, constantly, like, worried and nervous about things. Because it's not a lifestyle that you can't... You have to be able to steal a car and then not go, oh God, what if I get caught for stealing that car? No, you have to go about your day. And I've never understood, this is why I can never be a criminal. I could not go about my day. I do one crime and I'm like, oh my God, my life is ruined. I'm never going to, I could never do it.
It's not so much the anxiety. I mean, anxiety is part of it, but you know, these people are victims of a rash of mental illnesses and addictions that they don't have the wherewithal to address. That's a big part of the crime genre. In fact,
violent impulses, gambling problems, substance abuse. Jimmy's addicted to a variety of drugs.
All these addictions and vices and problems and mental illness issues are all things that people fall into a life of crime. They kind of go hand in hand because all of these sociopathic tendencies that are not being addressed kind of are welcome in a world of crime. It's like if you're a sociopath, you make a great organized criminal because you don't feel any guilt. You just steal a car and you drive off. And if a cop stops you, you just say, ah, nope, you didn't see me. Or, hey, here's some money, I'll just bribe you.
Yeah.
You know, they have that sort of confidence in this very real notion that the rules don't apply to them.
I think
I think a big part of organized crime movies is that people aren't in a place where they can address their problems. So they have to turn to crime because that's kind of their only option.
I feel like maybe the greatest line of dialogue I've ever heard about organized crime was actually not technically in a mob movie. It was in the movie Sneakers, where Ben Kingsley reveals that, you know, because he's like this smart computer hacker and he was in jail, he ended up befriending people in the mafia. And that was how he was able to stay alive, by being like their smart computer accountant guy. And Robert Redford says, really? Organized crime? And Ben Kingsley says, and what a great line. Don't kid yourself. They're not that organized. And that's what I feel it boils down to, is that this is not... this is not smart business. This is like effective business, maybe, but it's not like we came up with a great entrepreneurial model and we presented it to the bank. And like, no, this is something that just sort of happens. And so over the course of the series, the Black Donnellys go from basically one harebrained scheme to another. They find about halfway through the series, the boogie has been dead for a while, and all of a sudden his phone rings in the basement, which, what a great battery on that phone. That's been at least a week.
And this is a 2007 flip phone.
Like, come on. Like, that's what I don't buy here. But
actually, those flip phones had better battery life than smartphones. Still, they used a lot less electricity.
Still been a week. It's still plausible. Anyway, I'll let it go. The phone rings. And all of a sudden they realize, oh, the bookie left his phone here. And then they realize that the bookie kept all of their bookkeeping information on their phone.
So they decide to take over the bookie's business.
They go to everyone on the phone who owes money and says, oh, well, this person lost money on a bet. All we got to do is collect and say we come from like this what was it, Louis? Forget the name, Tony. Whoever was the original bookie was, the guy who died.
Oh, Bookie. His name is Bookie.
We'll call him Bookie. So they go to everyone who lost money, and Jimmy's just like, hey, we came here to collect. And when people say, I don't know you, and I'm not going to give you the money, he gets indignant. He's like, that guy's not going to give me my money. And every once in a while, people said, you know, it's not actually yours, right? And he's like, that's the principle of the thing.
The principle is you're trying to steal it.
Yeah, like, they owe money, but not to you. Like, I don't understand. So he gets, like, really indignant and weird about it, and, like, he just sort of, all of a sudden, now he is a bookie. Like, one episode later, they talk to, like, one guy who knows how to do math, and now they're bookies.
They need help doing bookie stuff, so they hire Kenneth Lonergan.
Great actor.
I love Kenneth Lonergan, there's a parallel universe where he and Mark Ruffalo have inverted careers. they kind of fulfill very similar roles.
He was also in The Departed.
That's right.
Yeah. That is one of the best.
I really, really love Kenneth Lonergan. Yeah. I like him in this because he seems a little bit like overwhelmed. He's kind of like a pathetic figure. I like the way he plays his character.
Yeah, like he knows what he's doing, but he also knows he is not the protagonist of his own story.
Yeah, he's sort of resigned himself to helping out other people who are more ambitious. So when he actually displays some wherewithal, when he decides he is in love, things go poorly for him. When he tries to be a protagonist, things fail for him. And I do like that about the character.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. And
indeed, he starts coming on to Jimmy's girlfriend.
Yeah, who is also a drug addict.
Who's a drug addict. And they start having sort of a flirtation, which leads to very bad things for Kenneth Lonergan.
It's not Kenneth Lonergan. No, it's Kenneth Lonergan.
Not Kenneth Lonergan.
Yeah, I was about to say, Kenneth Lonergan wrote and directed the films You Can Count on Me and Manchester by the Sea.
Oh my gosh, I totally... Kevin Corrigan.
Corrigan.
Lonergan Corrigan. You can see where I did.
Kevin Corrigan. That's
Kevin,
what it was. Thank
Kevin
you. That was,
Corrigan.
I knew that was wrong, and I couldn't correct you yet because I didn't have the name in front of me.
Apologies for that.
Kevin Corrigan is the actor.
Wire got crossed. Kevin Corrigan. Kevin Corrigan, not Kenneth Lonergan. Yeah. I've mixed up Upton Sinclair and John Updike before, so.
Yeah. Oh, well. In that case.
Just because they have up in their name.
Yeah.
So sorry. Kevin Corrigan is the name of the actor, and I do like Kevin Corrigan.
I like. You go to Kevin Corrigan's like IMDb page. Mm. And it has trademarks. Sometimes actors have trademarks, things that they do a lot. For example, plays gangsters / criminals. True.
Yeah, he's done it several times.
Razor sharp looks.
he's striking.
Yeah. Receding hairline. I don't know if that's a trademark or if that's just his hair.
It's
but
just the way his hair looks. He can put a wig on him.
And they go into more detail. Frequently plays criminals, drug dealer, drug addict, kidnapper, drunk, bank robber, drunk? Not necessarily a criminal if you're drunk.
I guess he's got a type. But
I mean, I know, it's just funny.
He is quite a good actor, even if he does play similar roles.
Yeah. He ends up getting swept into their bullshit, and it doesn't end well for him at all.
No.
Meanwhile,
Tommy's a frustrating character because he's like the leader, and you'd think he would, like, sort of step into the crime stuff, take care of a single crisis, and then try to step back.
Yeah, and then but try to resume a normal
exactly.
life.
Exactly.
It's inconsistent.
It is inconsistent. Like, so he does have sort of a normal life. He tries to instigate an affair with Olivia Wilde, but, she breaks it off really early in the series. Mm-hmm. He ends up falling in with a rich married woman who has always had the hots for him.
Hmm. Well, it's the widow of the guy he killed.
Oh, that's right. And
So he's got all this guilt, and now he's like hanging out with the dudes like son and like helping like the dude's widow like go through his things, and then they start having sex.
Yeah, and then he has to steal
from her house for Doki, because Doki is like in this weird power grab right now where he wants to control his family. And there's a funny bit where he has to like steal a box from this house. And then Doki finds out he's like hanging out with like the kid and like teaching him art, because Tommy was going to art school. And Doki just says, "I do not want my nephew hanging out with someone who would steal from that house." And Tommy's like, "You asked me to do that. We will not have that conversation." And I like that. Oh, that was
so,
a good bit.
So illogical.
Yeah.
But if Tommy had been in this position where he kept on trying to retreat to a normal life, or establish sort of a normal life, then his role in the Black Donnellys would have been a lot clearer.
Yeah.
But as it is, when he steps in to do the crime stuff, it takes a lot of the show.
Yeah.
It's like two full episodes are devoted to him cleaning up his brother's mess, and maybe a third of the next one to him trying to achieve a normal life.
Yeah, like he like ends up like doing an internship for an artist.
Yeah, played by William Sadler in one episode.
And then he just has to leave because his brothers are shits. That's it.
And yeah, that's it.
Okay.
I was hoping William Sadler would be like a regular on the show and be like sort of representative of his achievements of being kind of a non-criminal.
Well, like he has to leave for all this criminal shit, and William Sadler's like, "Well, if that's more important to you than art, you'll never be an artist." And I wanted him to come back and just say, my brothers were killing a guy with grenades. And then I want William Sadler to go, "That's really interesting. Stick around. Tell me stories." Like, I kind of wanted them to have, like, that relationship. Like
they had a confidant all of a sudden. That would that would have been nice, too.
Could have been interesting. You know, that's the way to handle it.
Should have started with that. But yeah, because Tommy spends so little time actually trying to express, you know, a life outside of the organized crime world, he seems more enthused about the organized crime world. So he's not a conflicted character as much as the show would have us believe.
What he is trying to do is he's trying to be a part of organized crime while being moral. Like, he's getting involved in all of that shit.
Well,
where, like,
when he wants, because he vacillates.
Like, he will do anything immoral to protect his family. But if someone from the neighborhood asks him for help, like there's a old lady who says, "Hey, there's some drug dealers that are hanging out in the lobby of my apartment, and they won't leave. The cops won't do anything about it. Can you do something about it?" And he ends up politely asking them to leave. That doesn't work. And so he brings his brothers with some baseball bats, and they beat the shit out of these guys. And then they come back to the bar, and they're feeling really good about themselves. Like, "Oh, good. We helped this old lady." And that's where Jimmy, who's, again, has been a drug addict this whole time, is like, "That old lady is a drug dealer. She sold me my first fix. All she did was trick you into eliminating the competition." And Tommy's like, "Well, fuck that lady." And they run in. They don't kill her, thank goodness. I think that would have been a step too far. But they steal the front door to her apartment. Which is admittedly a pretty good gag. So he's like trying to help people in the neighborhood, but he's really bad at it. And he ends up doing as much harm as good a lot of the time. We didn't mention the framing device for this show, which is very pronounced. Yeah. There is a guy named Joey Ice Cream.
Oh, gotcha. Okay, I'm going to admit it. I actually kind of love Joey Ice Cream.
Okay.
I have to apologize for that, because he's a really obnoxious character.
He is.
And the conceit of the entire show is that everything we witness is a story being told by Joey Ice Cream, who is a liar.
Yeah, Joey Ice Cream was tangentially connected to these events. And now at some point in the future, he's in prison and he is telling the story of everything that happened to the Donnelly brothers, to any lawyer that will listen, and he goes through like five of them. Any cop who will listen, and they never tells them what they actually want to hear.
Prison guard, just whoever's listening is going to tell him a story.
And in almost every single episode, someone points out that there is a logical inconsistency, or he is telling the story of something that happened when he wasn't in the room. And then he'll say something like, "Oh yeah, I was there too. I forgot about it."
And then we'll cut back and he'll be in the room.
Like, and everyone's like, "Hey, Joey.
Hey guys, oh hey Joey."
Which is admittedly kind of funny the first couple of times they do it. What it does is it gives
the entire series this weird sort of Adventures of Pete and Pete vibe.
I wish it had that, though.
Like, if it were a little kookier, I wish if it had that, it would have been great. But it does give a lot of a lot of the show anyway, at least the shows where Joey Ice Cream, the scenes where Joey Ice Cream is involved, this fantasy element, that this is this sort of fantastical thing that's just being made up by some guy who likes crime stories.
Yeah, it's got this sort of Usual Suspects kind of vibe to it. And I wish it had dealt, I wish that had been more of the premise, because I feel like Joey Ice Cream is in every episode. He does the previously on the Black Donnelly segment every time. And sometimes he's funny, sometimes he contributes nothing at all to the episode. But he's almost always talking about shit he shouldn't be able to know, like what's going on inside Tommy's head. And I never see you being Tommy's confidant. Mm. So I don't know why you would know this. Why are you like Mako in the Conan movies? Like, why are you his chronicler? Like, I don't really see it. And I wish it had had more of, because he's clearly an unreliable narrator, I wish it had just completely embraced it.
Yeah.
That we're just hearing this story of organized crime through the perspective of a liar who will make up details, and we never know what to truly believe. And this is all this kind of myth building, this like local myth building, which apparently was part of the influence of the show, was these local stories of real life Irish mobsters. Mm. And I think if it had embraced that and been more connected to that and allowed the show to be a little wittier, a little bit more funny,
playful
be the best way I'm going with this, because like, I mean, you can have your big moments, you can have your great tragedy, but just like there should, I feel like there's always this little distance, like where it's like Princess Bride, where you can take that story seriously, but in your heart of hearts, you know that Peter Falk is just telling this story to the kid from the Wonder Years. Fred Savage. Okay, I almost said John Savage. I knew that was wrong.
Fred Savage.
Okay. But you know it's a story being told, and as a result, you can like get away with stuff you might not otherwise have been able to. Apparently, what in the early drafts of this show, the title wasn't The Black Donnellys. It was The Truth According to Joey Ice Cream, which is a more colorful title, but try putting that on a billboard and see how well that hits the mainstream. I know why they changed it. I know why they changed it, is my point.
The 100 Lives of Joey Ice Cream.
Oh, God, I wish. I wish.
So, yeah, Joey Ice Cream is the narrator and ostensibly the one who's making up all of these stories. But, yeah, if there had been some playfulness with that meta-narrative quality, it would have been a lot more fun.
Yeah. Because every once in a while they'll do it, and I'm just like, you know, you haven't done that in like three episodes. Like, you know, make it part of the narrative. Make it part of it.
And then when these sort of bland, nondescript characters start doing really serious things, and we're supposed to get like down in the dirt with them, and clearly it's Sweeps Week, it's not interesting anymore. It's not interesting unless there is this sort of weird wit to it, or this kind of ironic approach, or a little bit of detachment from a lot of story beats that are actually really cliched.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, in a B plot that takes a couple of episodes, Olivia Wilde's character, she sort of, to get over both her husband and Tommy, has an affair with another guy.
Played by Badge Dale from Iron Man 3.
And she kind of makes it clear to him this was actually just another fling. I needed it for, like, my mental health.
Yeah.
But he doesn't take that very well and kind of starts stalking her.
Yeah.
And insisting that they be together, and then starts, like, really threatening her after a while. And she gets really scared.
Which is, it's a dark storyline, obviously. And it's sadly something that people have experienced. And it's fair, I think, to include it in almost any show. Because this kind of really frightening, creepy interaction with really shitty, toxic men, that can happen just randomly.
Yeah.
And I kind of appreciate that, but it's also, unfortunately, because the rest of the show is so interwoven, that subplot feels like it's off in its own separate universe.
Well, a lot of the Olivia Wilde stuff does, because a big drama for her is that her father, who's relatively young, he's like in his early 60s, I think.
Yeah, I mean, young, but like, yeah, he's not like,
he's not like in his 90s, he's not not infirm, but he is starting to become a little senile. He has early onset Alzheimer's, it's eventually explained.
Yeah.
And that's become a problem for the diner, because he takes the take for the day that he's supposed to be putting in the bank, and for the last X number of,
I think, 6 weeks,
deposits,
yeah,
has been leaving it in a mailbox.
Yeah, instead of putting it in the Dropbox for the bank, he's been leaving it in the mailbox across the street. Yeah, and now all of their bills are overdue, and they're fucked.
And she tries to shake down the mailman, who is clearly taking money out of the mailbox and not telling anybody, but that's sort of a dead end. So she's in financial dire straits. And it's only after that whole story, and, you know, the father goes to the hospital, after that story's been percolating for a while, that she starts turning to Tommy for some crime money so she can pay off all of her bills and keep the diner afloat.
They need to pay the rent. Doki is trying to take advantage of the situation by buying up half the diner, which, if you've seen Goodfellas, you'll know that, like, once the mafia, like, gets that invested in any business, they start...
It's essentially theirs.
It's essentially theirs. They will manipulate it in such a way to their advantage, and then the business can't hold anymore, and then they end up taking the whole damn thing. And which, of course, is all part of, like, this big... mysterious land deal. You know, like in movies,
the last two episodes, they finally reveal this. Like, this has actually been the plot the whole time, but it feels like they just made it up.
It's actually the plot to, like, Batteries Not Included, like, where it's like, oh, we've bought up every building in the neighborhood except for this diner.
Yeah.
And then we just have to get this diner. Like, it almost makes you wonder if, like, somehow Doki had, like, drugged her dad into being forgetful, and so, like, it was all part of a scheme, because otherwise it's just a great coincidence for Doki. But, like, yeah, so it's all about this big land grab, and again, they probably, it's one of those things
where,
like, these
connections to the local government, and again, all of these things about the land grab and the local government come down to, like, the last episode and a half. Like, it's not this big overarching thing.
I wish they had said what their plan was for the land, because if the plan is simply to knock down some buildings and build up some nice condos and, like, gentrify the neighborhood and make a lot of money, I'd be like, okay, that's just, like, 2% milk evil. You know, it's like, it's evil, but it's, like,
diet
commonplace.
Evil,
it's commonplace evil. Like, the last couple of times I've seen that plot, where, like, oh, we're trying to buy up every building in the neighborhood. It was, like, in Marvel's Daredevil, where it turns out that, like, we were trying to buy up the neighborhood so that this mysterious clan of ninjas can get at, like, the skeleton of a dragon that is buried underneath Manhattan so that they can use it to make... dragon drugs? Is that what that was? My point is, it was like they had a real end game involved. It wasn't just we want to build condos. Like,
the last movie I saw it in was Vampires versus the Bronx.
And
it turns out gentrification is the work of vampires.
That was
they're trying to move. They move into poor neighborhoods and they buy up all of the land because they need places to hide the coffins.
That's a really good movie.
It's a really good movie.
I like that movie.
The kids watch Blade for research purposes.
This is one of those shows where, like, individual episodes don't have, like, a distinct individual storyline enough for us to go through it episode by episode for it to make sense. But I think my favorite episode of The Black Donnelly is the one episode where I was just like, this episode I'm really grooving on, was basically after they managed to raise the money to basically mean that they don't have to sell half the diner to Doki. Doki manages to bribe, cajole, work with some of the people in, like, city planning to say that the building is not safe and should be condemned. And as a result, they'll lose the building anyway and Doki will get the land. Problem is, the building's fine. And they're told that, well, you know, it's going to be condemned today. If you try to put in the paperwork, it would take, like, 9 weeks to process anyway, so there's nothing you can do, you're fucked. And so they turn to the Black Donnellys, and the Donnellys are just like, so we have one day to cut through New York City bureaucracy. And they do. And that is an act of heroism.
That's their Ikiru episode.
Yeah, they kidnap a guy and they have that guy explain how to get through the bureaucracy, like what forms to fill out, how to get to the front of the line, and then we got to get this guy here by noon when normally he would take 6 weeks. And then he gets there, he takes one look at everything, says this is fine, and then he's like, okay, but this will take like another, like, you know, 9 weeks to get through the system. And they're like, okay, well, how do we get that done today? He's like, it's impossible. Okay, but how do we do it? Okay, get me a BMW. So they go to a valet. Like, where people
they just put on some valet vests and wait by a building, and somebody just hands them their keys and they just drive off.
Yeah, it's kind of an elegant solution I kind of admire. So they give him the keys to the BMW, and he says, great. And then he rubber stamps the paper. And they're like, that would have taken 9 months. The guy's like, what? That's the way it fucking works. And have you ever done anything with, like, the government or the IRS or local city planning, you know that, like...
It's such a massive bureaucracy.
It's just...
It takes so long.
It's not designed to be efficient. Mm. It's designed to be sort of self-perpetuating. It's not actually designed to be all that helpful most of the time. But if you know someone who knows someone, you can actually cut through it pretty cleanly. So that episode, I thought, was actually really great.
It's some, yeah, a little bit of cleverness there.
It certainly gave me something to wrap my head around.
I did like, I always liked the bits where they're actually not involved in anything criminal at all. Like the scenes with William Sadler, the art teacher.
Yeah.
There's a bit where Sean is begins this sort of romance with the young woman who sold them a jukebox for their bar.
Yeah, that's her yeah. job. She's a jukebox salesperson to like various bars and establishments, which is a fun gig if you can get it.
There's this utterly obnoxious scene where she's playing like some Creedence for. It's like, have you ever heard this Creedence song that's like licensed in every single movie? Mm. And Sean's like, no, I've never heard this song that everybody's heard. And well, here's something we could license for real cheap. Now, this is my elegant way of leading into the worst part of the show.
Yeah, we've talked about this.
And I think this was one of the many, many cases where a TV show or a movie will license some pop music for use for broadcast, but those licenses expire by the time it's time for home video or even for reruns.
Yeah. Or not expiring, it's just those are separate licenses and you might have to pay more for them. So that you can show it on TV, but you can't put it on the DVD or on the streaming service.
Charles Burnett's really brilliant film, Killer of Sheep, wasn't available for many years for that very reason. Yeah. There was a lot of music they couldn't license.
The animated movie Heavy Metal. They never had home video release on that.
Yeah. The MTV series The State. It was an MTV show, so of course they have access to this huge music library, which they didn't license for home video. So it wasn't on home video for many, many years.
We also ran into it several times on our show. Birds of Prey.
Yeah, Birds of Prey
had a big hip hop song in like for their opening credits, and then on home video they have a song with a completely different tone, and it is so generic. It's literally just a studio band. We've done research. No one knows who did the song. Like no one knows who did the like song
who,
on the DVD.
Who sang it? Who played it? What studio it was recorded?
Just
in.
Some generic track. And so the Black Donnellys, every once in a while they'll have a famous song, but the majority of the pop music on the soundtrack is bland.
It is really some of the worst musical choices that you could possibly have in a TV show. Because I don't know if there's something wrong with the mix, but they're always a little too loud or a little too quiet.
Uh-huh.
They overwhelm the drama in the scene just because of the way they overtake all of the action. And the mood is never right. It's like somebody dropped their iPod at the wrong moment and it started playing new metal during like a really scene that was supposed to be kind of like sweet and emotional.
Music needed to go in this spot and we're not going to really put in a lot of effort because the show wasn't a hit. But we are putting it on DVD, so just someone put any music there. So the music never really seems like it was carefully selected to match or even contrast action in the episodes.
I ended up, I have Shazam on my phone.
Yeah.
And I ended up trying to Shazam some of the bands in there, and there was just nothing.
Yeah. These
at all.
I'll bet these are like generic tracks that the studio has for when you need a little something on the radio and it's not worth getting any real music for in a scene. And I suspect the issues with the mix, and again, I watched like the pilot, but I don't remember it in a lot of detail. But we didn't watch this like on network television when it originally aired, so I imagine it was different.
Which also we couldn't have,
because
this is one of those beautiful DVD releases that has those magical words with episodes not aired.
Yeah, that's true.
This only aired 6 episodes; the remaining 7 were only available on DVD.
There you go. But regardless, we didn't get to see these episodes, any of the episodes other than the pilot again, when they were on the air. So I couldn't tell you what the music and the soundtrack actually sounded like. But if I were to venture a guess, those issues with the mix that you're talking about were probably we had to remove a more popular or more expensive song.
We had to lay something over something that was already there.
But we're not going to go through all the efforts to actually peel apart the sound effects track. Because I noticed there's like one episode where like there's a van driving away and it's really intense. And like some people are shooting at them. And all of a sudden, all the sound effects drop out. And then it didn't seem like it was a dramatic choice. It felt like the sound effects were supposed to be here, but we had to replace those with the most generic music possible as quickly as possible. So just the entire thing is undercut. I want you to just imagine like any, pick a good movie. Think of a movie that has like really good musical choices. And the first thing that comes to mind, and I know this is a complicated issue to have a conversation with for you, but like, is Pulp Fiction. The music in Pulp Fiction is very carefully chosen.
Can't talk about Pulp Fiction. How about how about a Coen Brothers movie? they do good soundtracks as well. Or John Waters.
John Waters. I'm trying to think here.
Linklater.
I'm trying to think of a movie with like a really... Forrest Gump. Forrest Gump has a very good soundtrack. Like all the hits from the 60s.
Yeah.
Okay? Now, I want you to imagine that in all of those scenes in Forrest Gump where like these iconic songs from the 1960s were playing, I want you to imagine you just take out that song. And put some song you have no emotional connection to, you've never heard before, that was doesn't have like an interesting hook, that doesn't have a catchy tune, that doesn't have any peaks and valleys. It's all very like, like just a C. It's just playing the C note over and over again with some generic lyrics and just putting those over those same scenes. It's not going to have the same power.
No.
It's just not. There's a reason why there's actually like jobs on movies to find and place the right music, like to find music that we can afford, that we can get the rights to, and actually put it together. So,
can you imagine the Pulp Fiction opening credits if it were like a Beach Boys song?
Be a different movie. Yeah. Well, it's kind of surfy. It's got Miserloo, but like, regardless. But like, yeah, can you imagine if it was like, ABBA? Yeah. ABBA would be a very different vibe, wouldn't it?
I'll execute every last one of you motherfuckers. You can dance. You can dance.
Well, again, there's a lot of there's a lot of like sort of experimentation with this I find on the internet. Like this is a cute example. It's not like an amazing example, but like in The Falcon and the Winter Soldier, there's a scene where the Falcon and the Winter Soldier and the villainous Baron Zemo, who returns from Captain America: Civil War. Daniel Brühl.
Daniel Brühl.
Yeah, Daniel Brühl shows up.
Not August Diehl.
Yeah, they have to like
different German actor.
They have to break Daniel Brühl out of prison in order to help them, so he can help them like track down some criminals. And honestly, he's great. He's better in this show than he is in that movie. Like he's a really good character in the show. But there's a scene where they have to like go to a nightclub. And while they're waiting to talk to some like evil person like behind the scenes, they just have to mingle. So there's this one shot of Daniel Brühl as the villainous Baron Zemo just grooving out to some music.
Just hanging out.
It's like a 5-second clip. But you can see like online there's like a whole Twitter account that's just dedicated to putting different music to that dance.
Oh, yeah.
And you can see just how like, and it's a very simple exercise, and you can do it at home, you can do it. It's a good exercise where you can learn the power of music to do with a scene. Just take any scene and just put different music over it. And just see how it affects the scene. It will make it absurd. It will make it funny. It will make it romantic. It will make it tragic. But like, yeah, just suck out the music from a scene, put other music over it to see what happens. And you'll realize just how much influence this has. So when you have a musical accompaniment that is so with so little effort put into it, it undermines a lot of scenes in this show that like probably could have been effective, but when you're watching them at home and it's just like, I give no shits and I wish you would turn this crap off on the radio.
It's really, and we're mentioning it because it is incredibly distracting.
Yeah,
it's not just like bad music choices. Yeah. It's something that pulls you right out of the show time and time again. Yeah.
I'd be surprised if the people on the show were happy with these music choices. I don't know that for a fact, but this feels like, again, it's a fair critique because it's what we've got, but it also is a little unfair to blame the Black Donnellys for it. So, like, it's hard to watch, but I'm not going to blame the showrunners too much for it.
Yeah, the showrunners were not responsible for probably a lot of those new musical choices.
I would be very surprised.
Clearly late-minute replacements. But because this is the only way we can see it...
It does hurt.
Yeah. This is what we got. Maybe at some point,
yeah,
if this somehow gains any kind of traction... Which it won't, but if it does,
this is how the show is called.
They might re-release it with the proper music cues, and the show would be maybe slightly better.
I think this show has a proper cult.
Okay.
We've had a lot of requests for the show over the years, and I know some people are very excited about the prospect of us doing it, and they keep saying, I love the Black Donnellys, and you look at, like, clips on YouTube or whatever, and people are like, I missed this show so much, I can't believe they canceled it. The show sometimes ends up on lists of the best canceled too soon shows ever made. I personally don't quite see it. I've definitely seen worse
well, this
programs,
is,
but yeah. I also find this frustratingly generic, except for a couple of things that don't go far enough. Like, again, the whole unreliable narrator bit, that's the hook. That's the thing that makes this interesting, and it's not really that important to the show. So ultimately, all I'm left with is a reasonably competent but not spectacularly distinctive crime saga.
And it's called The Black Donnellys, and it's about the four brothers. They're the four main characters, and everybody else is sort of support to them. I think it would have played a lot better if it had been more of a full ensemble.
Yeah.
And there were people in and out of the crime world who had reacted to each other in different ways. In other words, just put Kate Mulgrew in a more central role.
She needed
to be, like, a little bit more of a mom to these characters and sort of, like... There needed to be, like, some sort of moral compass better than Tommy.
Or you could have made her more of, like, a Ma Barker kind of thing, where she's actually, like, maybe encouraging them. That would have been fine, too. But, it would have really... I think we needed that energy. Because this, like, young punk, you know, getting drunk and hitting each other because we're 20 and we don't know what else to do energy... I'm sorry, I find it a little tiresome after a while. And I needed more counterpoints to it. And unfortunately... the counterpoints that we have are Olivia Wilde, who's very good, but is also
with the main characters a lot.
She doesn't interact with them a lot. Too often she is presented as the prize that they want to win, and I just feel like she doesn't get enough opportunities to really shine. And then you have these, like, older gangster mafioso characters who are playing the same shtick we've seen a million times before, just, like, they're just in the system more, and all of a sudden these rowdy kids are kind of come on and shake things up. I feel like giving Kate Mulgrew more to do other than to tell the kids, you know, make sure you come in for dinner and stay in your room and stay away from my son, I don't trust you, lady who I do not approve of kind of vibe. She had more to do.
Yeah.
She's Kate Mulgrew, give her more to do, for fuck's sake.
And they brought her into the story at the end, but not in a way that she got to take charge of the story. In fact, she became a victim right at the end.
Yeah, it's really annoying.
The big cliffhanger at the end of the series is she's shot. After all of this land grab stuff, everything comes to a head with Doki, and in a big sort of gun battle, because we finally exploded in gun violence, she gets shot, and they're driving off in a van, trying to leave town.
Yeah, they all jump in a turtle wagon, basically, and try to leave town, because it's basically like, it's not worth it, we stirred the pot too much, we all gotta get out of here. Doki killed our dad, which, by the way, is a thing that happened, so... He knows that we know. We beat him up, but we didn't kill him, and now he's out for revenge, and we just need to get the fuck out of here. And so before they do, they're confronted by all these guys, and they start a firefight, and it just kind of ends in the middle of it. It ends like The Devil Inside. Like, all of a sudden, everything's really dangerous in a car, and then credits. It doesn't feel like much of a cliffhanger. It definitely doesn't feel like a season cliffhanger. It feels like a next week cliffhanger.
Yeah.
Which is a bit frustrating.
There's a lot that's frustrating about this, and I can kind of understand why this would get a following given the context. If you saw it when it first came out, when this kind of drama was a little bit more novel, then I could see getting really involved in it. But I feel like this one's been outstripped by all of the years since. You know, it's been 14 years since this series aired, and you know, in that 14 years, we've had a lot bigger, more ambitious stories that have worked a lot better than something like this.
I think it's also fair to say that its story of a world of crime and hedonism and sex and drugs and violence probably wasn't as easy. I think it might have been more difficult to really, like, tell this story in the confines of network television. Where this is actually surprisingly violent. There are people getting their faces burned off with waffle irons and shit. But, like, it's still the sort of thing where, like, they do have very specific constrictions of what is possible, what they can show, what they can't show. And there may have been... I feel like there are certain shows, in particular Game of Thrones, I think, is sort of the ultimate example of this. Is the episode not working? Throw in some sex. Is the episode not working? Decapitate somebody. Like,
murder a character.
Yeah, like, and again, I'm being a little cynical about this, but I think sometimes Game of Thrones did it effectively, and I think sometimes Game of Thrones did it just because we needed something in this scene to get our interest back up again, because sometimes the episodes can be kind of slow. Raymond Chandler had a whole bit about, oh, is the scene boring?
just two guys with guns burst in.
Yeah, and he did this all the time. He did this all the time.
Yeah, just once you know that axiom, you notice a lot in his work.
Yeah, and it's just basically sometimes the scene is boring, and then something exciting has to happen, and the excitement, like our ability to be like, whoa, is limited in a story about sex and violence if you can't show the sex and violence. Mm. So I feel like some of the key tricks that were being used to spice up this kind of narrative series were kept from the makers of the Black Donnellys because it was on network TV and they had fewer options.
Yeah.
So would it have made it a better show? Not necessarily, but it might have made it a little bit more exciting to watch. And I think there's something to be said for that.
Also, I wish there had been a greater variety of character types. I feel like the Donnellys, while they have distinct personalities, are a little too similar to one another. Like there's not a they fight, but all because it's just because they're all kind of equally angry in the same sort of way.
There's at least two of them I mixed up constantly. I think it was like Kevin and Sean. I like mixed up all the time.
Yeah,
like just they're the same character to me.
And
if you don't mention that they're gambling, I can't tell them apart.
Yeah, you know, we have the Olivia Wilde character, but she doesn't sort of interact with the main characters at all to give any kind of counterpoint.
Yeah.
There's William Sadler, who's in one episode.
Yeah.
There's not enough of inter-character dynamics. We're so deeply ensconced in this world that I'm longing for a little bit more visual variety. Well, and I think this might have been a reaction to The Sopranos, where that's a mob story, and it's from what I understand of The Sopranos, they're just all in it, like the entire family.
Yeah, they're episode one. They're already like deep into.
Yeah, like the entire family is involved. Yeah.
It's not about falling into organized crime. It's just about living in it.
Yeah. So about an entire family that's living within organized crime, we get to sort of explore that world. The problem is the world of the Donnellys isn't that interesting a world, really.
No,
they're kind of stumbling through a lot of this stuff.
A lot of the characters kind of feel like stock archetypes.
Yeah.
Which just, you can't rely on that for very long. And unfortunately, we just rely on it for the whole series in the case of some characters. And that's very frustrating. So the stock archetypes are frustrating. There's a certain amount of cultural stereotyping that we're seeing a lot of. There's a line early on that Joy Ice Cream has, where he talks about how everyone thinks that all the Irish like to do is get drunk and punch a guy. And it's really aggravating to be reduced to that kind of cultural stereotype. It just makes you want to get drunk and punch a guy.
Mm-hmm. And which is a cute joke.
It's a cute joke, but it also is. Here's the deal. This show was, I think, created or co-created by Paul Haggis. Paul Haggis was the writer and director of the Best Picture winning Crash, which is a terrible motion picture.
It is not a good film.
No, and it's one of the most frustrating things about the film is that it attempts to have a conversation about the state of affairs of a race in America, or in particular Los Angeles. But what it ultimately does is it presents us with a series of stock, sometimes very offensive archetypes, and then has a conversation about how, reducing people to a stereotype is bad, but then the movie also says that people fall into those stereotypes constantly. Mm. And I find
that's lampshading it a bit, isn't it?
All that really is basically like saying, like, we're doing these stereotypes, but we're going to call attention to them, so that makes it okay. And ultimately, very little in that movie ends up feeling like it means anything. Because all it really is a justification for our preconceptions about all of these characters. And I think that sucks. I think that's shitty storytelling. I think it's not an interesting theme. I actually think it's a really kind of unhelpful theme. Because what it ultimately argues is that people may complain about being reduced to racist stereotypes, but then all the characters fit those. That's shitty. I'm sorry. I think it's shitty writing. And I think there's that kind of bleeds into the Black Donnellys a bit, where you can have that line it sucks to be like reduced to like this cultural stereotype of what Irish gangsters are, and then you just do all that shit as though now it's okay. I don't think it is. I think it's lazy.
if they were addressing those stereotypes and it was a little bit more authentic, like if they actually, if you said that this is inspired by actual local legends and actual like local criminals and the way people talked about them in the neighborhood, if it were more about the actual neighborhood and we got to see more characters talking about these Donnellys and we got to know a little bit more specific things about these particular characters and the way they carried out real crime in the real world, then we could have much more serious conversations about real world people dealing with the anxiety of bursting out of and unfortunately sometimes living, like leaning into stereotypes, which is, you know, something every group deals with. And that would have been something a little bit more interesting. That's something that they could have tackled with intelligence, but they don't do that. They just have the stereotypes, and like you said, they have the stereotypes and then they just do them. And that's not a fun story. That's lazy.
No, I think it sucks, honestly. And quite a few of the cast members of this show, some of them incidental, some of them not, like Pablo Schreiber shows up in this show. Some of them are from the TV series The Wire, which I believe you haven't seen.
I've seen 4 episodes of The Wire.
Okay. Well, the thing about The Wire, some people call it the best TV show ever made. I have called it that. Not sure if I still would, but I think it's up there. There's something to be said for The Wire, maybe less so for season 5 where it starts getting a little weird, but like there's an authenticity to it. Like the people did their research and it stars people from Baltimore.
Yeah, and then they shot it in Baltimore.
Yeah, they shot it in Baltimore. They actually they hired actors and non-professional actors, like people who actually like grew up in Baltimore and were part of organized crime in Baltimore and have since like turned their lives around, and now they're actually acting in the show, playing similar characters, very different characters. The show feels like it doesn't take place in bullshit TV universe. The show feels like it is, again, sometimes the plot gets a little implausible, but it feels like the everyday stuff in it is grounded. And I think there's 2 things you can do. You could either ground it, which would be a great way to do it, because then you really feel like you've explored something, or you lean into the fact, once again, that you have an unreliable narrator and get weird. And it feels like the show kind of wants to do both and ends up never doing either very well.
Homer, you had a head. Oh, yeah, I guess I did.
So the Black Donnellys. The Black Donnellys, if it had lasted 100 episodes, I'm going to call it Tommy Would Have Killed Jimmy.
Yeah.
Tommy would have killed Jimmy towards the end of the series. There's no way.
It would have been like the end of season 3 or so.
Yeah, or maybe the second to last episode or something like that. But that would have been the thing that dooms them all, is that Jimmy dies.
How long before Breaking Bad murdered somebody?
Actually, pretty quick.
I thought it was like at like 3 seasons. Like he always flirted with the idea, but it wasn't until like 3 years in that he finally actually.
Well, they had to like. I'm trying to remember the details. Like they had to dispose of a body. The idea was actually like originally the show was supposed to lead to. Who's the actor? Who's the guy? It's late. I'm blanking out. It was
Bryan Cranston.
Bryan Cranston. Thank you. It was originally the idea was that Bryan Cranston was supposed to like push through the ranks of the criminal underworld really fast. And you can see, like, because the first season is only like a half season. Like, at the end of that season, he's already kind of a badass. And then they backtracked really, really fast. And they were able to do that because there was a writer's strike that cut it off. And they realized that, oh, this should take longer. So they actually, like, he did something really badass. And then they kind of just don't talk about that very much. And then he kind of like regresses a little bit and then gradually becomes the truly twisted evil mastermind.
Okay.
But I do believe in season 1 there's some death. I can't remember how intentional it is. But anyway, it takes a bit. But regardless, maybe that's not the ideal example. But
yeah, I hadn't seen the show, but I understand that he didn't murder somebody for like a little while. And that's like he crossed that line like a little later into the show.
I'm having trouble remembering, honestly.
Whether or not that's the case, that's maybe what they should have done with the Black Donnellys. Like, at the end of season 3, Tommy finally kills Jimmy.
Yeah.
Kills one of his own brothers. And then that becomes this big moment of drama within the family, but, like, in so doing, it would also, because of plot complications, sort of, like, propel him further up in the crime world.
Yeah.
And that would be sort of the drama. That's predictable drama, but at least that's kind of what would happen.
It would be a good sort of mirroring, too, because this whole business started with him trying to protect his brothers from being killed. Mm. And now they're so deep in it, and the only way to protect his other brothers is to kill that brother himself. And he starts learning about, like, once you're in this level of organized crime, you have to do things like that in order to keep power. And that becomes, like, this sort of self-sustaining, shitty, evil system.
Again, this would be another parallel with The Godfather, because that's exactly what happened in that movie.
Yeah, that's more or less. Well, in The Godfather, he can't do it until their mom dies, and it's this whole thing. But anyway, the show had gone on while I can kind of see where some of it is going. I'm sure they would have thrown in some, like, fun character actors who show up as bad guy of the season. Like a new,
Robert Davi.
Robert Davi. Whereas, like, have you seen Peaky Blinders?
No.
I fell off of it, but, like, it was pretty cool. Like, season two, like, all of a sudden, like, Tom Hardy shows up as, like, this weird, creepy, I think it was a butcher, who was also, it was like Bill the Butcher, basically. Yeah. And he just shows up for, like, one season to just throw a monkey wrench into everything and be awesome and sexy. And I'm like, yeah, more of that, please. I just want, like, more, like, bring some interesting character actors in to just be larger-than-life figures. That'd be cool.
You know what they really needed? Like, they needed a Frank Gorshin as the Riddler. Like, complain with the outfit. Why the hell not? Yeah. They need, like, a really weird supervillain.
Need larger-than-life people. That's what I'm about. Yeah.
These main characters are such, like, wet shirts. They're just sort of, like, baseline archetypes.
Yeah.
That they need, like, one wacky guy that they can play straight man to, essentially.
Yeah.
Just some... not better than Doki. Doki was actually kind of a dangerous character. I mean, just somebody who's completely unpredictable.
Well, I think that's what they were going at with Jimmy after a while, when he starts, like, grabbing a rocket launcher and trying to do crazy shit, and actually he's not very good at it, but...
No, you need a Paul Kersey or Jason Statham in the Fast and Furious movies.
The Vigilante in town might have been an interesting thing to explore. That would have been kind of cool, but... Anyway, was the Black Donnellys canceled too soon?
No, I don't need to see more of this story. Okay. I'm not so involved in the lives of the Donnellys that I need to see where they're going from here.
Yeah, I'm frustrated because it wasn't like... It's not like a particularly bad show. Like, I've definitely, like... I wasn't offended by it. I was bored by it sometimes, but I wasn't, like, thinking to myself, oh, what a terrible series. But I also was never thinking, what a great series either. And I can appreciate why this would be the kind of show that some people would really get into. Totally get it. And I did factor that into my thought process. But what it boils down to is, no, I'm good.
No,
Olivia Wilde got to be in-house and then yada, yada. Now Booksmart. Yeah. So like, we get Booksmart out of this. So I'll take that. Yeah, thank you. But that's hindsight is 2020. At the time, I'm like, again, I had to look at the ratings, but I'm looking at the show and going, eh.
Olivia Wilde, yada, yada. Who could forget the Lazarus effect? Oh, wait, everybody. Everybody forgot
that movie. It's not her fault. Come on.
No, but it's a forgettable, it's a weird aberration. The guy who made Jiro Dreams of Sushi and, the Mumblecore crowd and Olivia Wilde and Donald Glover are going to make this really generic demonic possession thriller.
Well, it's like Frankenstein, but Frankenstein comes up with, like, this person dies, they use their technology to bring them back, it's Olivia Wilde,
but she comes back with a demon inside of her,
Yeah, which is, like, again, that's a pretty generic setup for a horror movie, and you've got a pretty good cast there, and you do nothing with either of those things. It's so bad.
But we got Booksmart out of it. Yeah,
that's the important thing.
The Black Donnellys is not an interesting enough show to continue. The only times I thought it was bad was when they had those really horrible music cues.
And again, it's hard to blame the show.
I can excuse the horrible music cues because I know that wasn't the original intent.
Yeah. Anyway, that's it for Cancel Too Soon this week. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Next time, we will be back with a show that I have been wanting to cover since we started this program. But it wasn't available for a really long time. Only a couple of episodes aired. I know they had shot the entire thing, but it wasn't on home video. Wasn't widely available. I looked. Like, I couldn't even find it on, like, bootlegs. And then, sure enough, it just showed up on Tubi. Just popped in there.
Thanks, Tubi, for sneezing out every last little bit of pop ephemera. Yeah.
So we've got coming up a short-lived... 7-episode television series from one of the producers of Firefly, not that one, And it's starring such folks as Nathan Fillion, Emma Stone, Melanie Lynskey, Charles Martin Smith, Amy Acker. Like, it's actually a pretty damn good cast. And it is a cross-country race thriller called Drive.
Not to be confused, unfortunately, with Blood Drive.
No.
Which is also a cross-country race.
No, thriller. I'm going to tell you, stop you right now. It's nowhere near as crazy as Blood Drive, but what is?
Nothing is as crazy as Blood Drive.
That's a high bar.
Blood Drive is pretty bloody unique. Yeah.
This Drive is, imagine the Cannonball Run if the people running the race killed you if you came in last. Like, that's it.
Perfect.
Like, so you got big characters showing up, you get like a big prize at the end, a couple of people don't even want to be there, but like their wives have been kidnapped or whatever, and I saw the first two episodes, and then they didn't air anymore, even though there were only seven of them. So now I get to finally see how this damn thing ends, and I'm very, very excited. So it's on Tubi. We're going to be talking about that next time on Cancel Too Soon. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Very special thank you in particular to our patrons. Without our patrons, our show would not exist.
Also, the Black Donnellys was a donation from one of our patrons.
Yes, I want to give a special thank you for that.
So special thanks to the patron who donated, who I think preferred to remain anonymous.
That's true. But we do have some more donations. We know we're... We have no idea how backlogged we are on Cancel Too Soon. There's no shortage of these things. We have a giant library. But a very special thank you to people who donate. And we will get to your shows eventually. They're all in the pipeline. But also a special thank you to our patrons, without whom these shows would not exist. We wouldn't be here without you. So I just want to make sure you have your moment. If you want to join up in our Patreon, if you have the means, head on over to patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. We have a lot of exclusive shows for you, including shows about Star Trek, Batman, Disney, the Academy Awards. We do commentary tracks. We have a lot of stuff over there, huge backlogs of stuff. You can check that on out over at patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. If you want to talk about the Black Donnellys or anything else that might interest you for us to discuss, you're more than welcome to write us an email. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We might read and respond to one of your emails on an upcoming episode of our podcast, We've Got Mail. You're also welcome to follow us on Twitter @CriticAcclaim. I am @WilliamBibiani.
I'm @WhitneySeibold.
And of course, head on over to Etsy.com and look for Salt Cat Soap, all one word. Look for a wonderful image of Luca with soap, and you will find designer soaps designed by mostly my wife and partner, M. Lapis da Silva, a few designed by myself. Over there, and we just dropped a whole bunch of new designs, a set of bath salts, hand lotions. There's a lot of exciting stuff out there. It's probably too late for Mother's Day, but just tell your mom you got lost in the mail and it showed up a couple of days late. Also, there's also plenty of reasons to have soap, because it's soap. We all need soap. Thank you, soap, for being soap. And it's really late, and I'm getting kind of loopy, so thank you to Whitney.
You're quite welcome.
Because he's great. Any of the best.
Oh, pish.
We don't talk about him. He's amazing. Fooled. I love him so much. I wouldn't do all these shows with him if he wasn't the best. So thank you, everybody. Thank you, Whitney. And that's a wrap. We'll see you next season of Drive. Specifically.